Here we stand and here we stay. It's time to let the storm rage on. Poetic peeps and gentle persons, in betweeners and nonconformers, genders all and genders equal, welcome to Eat the Storms, the poetry podcast. This is episode 8, season 8. My name is Damien B. Donnelly, your host and producer, and thank you so much for joining us today, tomorrow, yesterday, next week, or maybe even next year on platforms like Spotify, Apple, Google, Breaker, Podbean, Player FM, Overcast, Pocket Cast, Castbox, Podcast Addicts, or iTunes. Today on the show, we have two trips to the United Kingdom, one trip to the United States, and two layovers here in Dublin. We are bringing you bright painted collages, solstice bonfires, dumbbells and bumblebees, meetings on frosty paths in COVID-coated cities of concrete, one true rollerblader with a reputation on the line, blackbirds, song thrush, tistle thrush, black-capped birds, and we measure time in white horses. And of course, to end this episode, we're going back to the beginning to talk about beginnings, our first loves of poetry, as we chat to one of my guests on Behind the Storms, our new chat segment. So, for now, all that's expected of you is to settle back down in the comfort of a park bench or park your car, position yourself on the sofa or take a cheeky plunge into bed, because for the next hour and 10 minutes, I'm going to introduce you to four voices of poetry to sweeten your day. My name is Damien B. Donnelly, this is Eat the Storms, and I hope you enjoy the show. To get the show moving today, I'm delighted to welcome a returning guest to Eat the Storms, originally from Antrim in Northern Ireland and now living in London in the United Kingdom. He was the winner of the Eric Gregory Award in 2007 and an International Writing Fellow at the University of Iowa in 2010. His collections include Still This Need, Fossil Sunshine, and in 2023, Whirlpool published his latest collection, Because We Could Not Dance at the Wedding. Thankfully, he will be back again at the end of today's podcast to talk about his love of writing, what got him interested in poetry, and to talk more about his latest collection and the two poems he's going to share today with us. I am very happy to hand you over for the first time today to Michael McKim.
Hi, everyone. And thank you, Damien. It's great to be here on the Eat the Storms podcast. Today I'm going to read a long poem from my collection, Because We Could Not Dance at the Wedding. As a bit of background, in 2020, at the beginning of the COVID lockdown, I was invited to contribute to a project called Arrival at Elsewhere. This was curated by the Welsh poet Carl Griffin. Carl had asked us to send him lines and phrases describing our experiences of the lockdown, which he threaded into a book-length poem of overlapping voices. And some of the pieces which I contributed, I later worked into this long poem. It's called What the Greenfinch Actually Sounds Like. It takes the form of a series of short diary entries, alternating between scenes of me looking out the window and our daily walk exploring Wanstead Flats, which is a large parkland near our home. Just one thing that I think needs explaining is that during the COVID pandemic, a temporary morgue was constructed on the parkland where we took our daily walks. The poem has an epigraph by Robert Frost, which is Tree at My Window Tree. It also references another Robert Frost poem, Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening. That's because of one of our walks, we had this surreal moment when we found a line from that poem graffitied in these giant, beautiful letters on a garage door. What the Greenfinch Actually Sounds Like. I hoover the dust off some 4 kilogram dumbbells, find exercises online and set 2 in front of an upstairs window. Goblet squat, bent over row, cross body hammer curl, lateral raise. I watch our neighbour's cat disappear below the fence line. We hear a song like a winnowing hinge and follow it through the gorse, finding a greenfinch calling from a bramble. Butterflies everywhere we turn. We look them up when we get home. Speckled wood, orange tip, brimstone. I listen to Beast Mode on Spotify as I lift the dumbbells, right arm first for 10, then left, then repeat. A bumblebee as big as the phalanx of a thumb dozes up to the window, bounces off the glass a few times, and drifts away. The horse chestnut as electric neon leaves. We come across a swathe still reeling from the grass fire 2 years back, black, tormented, clawing at the sky. I begin to collect favourite trees, the oak in bush wood that sits alone where 3 paths meet, its branches low and long and scoring the air like lightning. Bicep curl, overhead press. Small movements in the horse chestnut flick to the fence. A wren no bigger than a walnut, tail like the shoehorn in the heel of a clog, its irrefutable song spinning out across the gardens. A daily needling that I should feel luckier or sadder or more afraid. I dream an indoor swimming pool filled by a melting glacier, and wake with what I guess you'd call survivor's guilt. How still the pool must be now. To paraphrase Robert Haas, maybe you need to write a poem about guilt. Looping west round shoulder of mutton pond to gobby bird song, flustered leaves and shadows darting across the path. Black caps, we study them through binoculars. Their scuffed punk hairdos like they've also taken the clippers to themselves. Horse chestnut flowers blow in through the window and land at my feet as I lift the weights. A fine sweet scent, white petals with pink swirls like raspberry ripple. Maybe you need to write a poem about gratitude. What the greenfinch actually sounds like is a single cicada placed deep in a tree, its hot rattling rasp slowed and elongated to a creaking purr. Or a cow box toy turning out a lackadaisical moo, beginning with some momentum, then petering off with a shrug of exhaustion. In a knuckle of woods, a slatted garage door painted with foot-high bubble letters. The woods are lovely, dark and deep, but I have promises to keep. I go through nettles and Spanish bluebells to take a photo. Miles to go before we sleep. Droplets static on the window, nudged from their fastenings by the newly fallen, slip like tadpoles down the pane, chicane through bubbles of their sister spawn. A crow glosses the chimney tops. The world is more silent than ever in this cocoon of cloud and water. Sun flares off the taut white skin of the temporary morgue, which sits there in the woods like a wedding marquee. We are stopped in our tracks by parabolas of sunlight, spellbound with spores of bulrush and dandelion and who knows what, fairy dust floating and dancing softly through the air. Some sort of warblers gossiping in the hawthorn, shopping around for evening snacks and furnishings. I have a vision of my mum and Auntie Margaret in Marks and Sparks, picking things up and putting them down again, their conversation unbroken and overlapping and untroubled by time. I watch our neighbour's cat settle down like a small loaf to bake in the sun. The conkers are coming already, little spiny balls, neon green. They look like virus particles. What the greenfinch actually sounds like: grating nutmeg, sharpening a rusty knife. I'd just like to finish with a poem called Rummy Cub in County Antrim. My dad rearranges postage stamp tiles so they face the same way on the small coffee table in the garden at Carnkirk. This rare day we can sit outside, no drop of wind. And both my mum and I are yet to go down, my pieces spilling off the rack and hardly hidden. And Zach is running away with it, connecting colours and numbers with a focused sweep of his eyes and fingers busy as flies. So Mum is sighing and putting her head in her hands, and Dad is laughing and saying we've got some competition here. And I am so stuck and adrift, I'm looking across at the sea and beaten rocks and thinking of prayer. For mine was a basalt prayer for the hundred ways it could have gone, dark and hot and troubled even now. A prayer I need to close with a black amen, to cast my runes at last and place with care. To look at these three, looking at the game, together, and to know it isn't luck. It isn't only luck.
From that cut of the Antrim coast, we are taking flight and heading over to the United States, to Central Virginia, for a poet, writer, visual artist, and a documentary filmmaker whose collections include Lamentations on the Tattoo Queen with Finishing Line Press, Reap, a Flora, from Shipwrecked Books, from which you're going to hear poems today, Eat the Marrow, and Beast. Her work has appeared in anthologies like the Stony Thursday book, Southwards Munster Literature, the London magazine, Mislexia, Magma, and Abridged. She has twice been nominated for a Pushcart Prize and shortlisted for a number of awards, including the Arts University Bournemouth International Poetry Prize, the Magma Pamphlet Publication Award, and the National Poetry Society UK. Joining us for the first time today on Eat the Storms, but hopefully not the last, this is Mara Adamitz-Scroupe.
I'm Mara Adamitz-Scroupe, and I'll be reading to you today from my recently released collection of poems called Reap, a Flora. The book was published by Shipwrecked Publishing from Winona, Minnesota, and it is available on Amazon for $18.95. Sfumato. That was our summer of glorious ripe, of bright painted cottages and cottagers dabbling touch-ups, of burnished midnights and endless cups of coffee. That summer in which near alpine birds descended on blur-edged wings, their contours rendered softly as they appeared from a distance to naked eyes. That summer of pageants and spectacles meant to dissipate our discontent in tears and heat obscurant, that summer of alluring girls lounged on angel-built precipices, on pierced palisades, our pink pulp stretched to haze. That summer, as vigilantes stacked, secluded, in fjords, indistinct across the veil, in equivalents of painterly sfumato, illusions of death and sex and innocence and intimacy, rudimentary as dry wash and Conte mapped. In our enigmatic smiles and eyes, that summer we busted out labially, blushed ruddy in corseted illusions, such profusions. That summer of berserker solstice bonfires, burning close, explicit, and clear. I'll follow that with another piece that is actually about sisters. The entire book really is based on allusions to plant life. So you will hear that emerging again and again. Balsam, sister, sister. In faint branchlets pricklings against our palms, in pungent and silvery tipped, poked and stranded threads against bare feet, in spice-scented darkness, half-drunk as goddesses, we dreamt ourselves up. In lantern's absence, we shined, imagine windows in aesthetic consolation, row upon row. Dear God, how we shone. Sister, sister, spirally on the chute, in slight, in serrated pinked push against calves at frond's edge. Tickled and blooded and groped, we claimed our time in pure madness of being alive. Or much later, older, saner, in shady, stippled light, soul and satisfied for the makings of our hands, in crucibles forged hack silver, in mill fiori beads cut from molten cullet. We covered our nakedness with tesserae sharps, sandwiched shining in gold foil, like our mother's mother's evergreen was our first best choice. Afloat as resin's balm, as unguent and poultice for sting and outrage, the old man's pollens released. We moved in remembered dreams, our bodily incense stoked the viewing. We birthed Beate in our crevices, oh, the balsam. Musk marked us rich beyond knowing, unfathomed in our wealth. Pressed and balanced, our toes and fingers claimed cold slate slabs without chancel or stained glass partitions to protect us. Flying, falling, sister, sister, we kept still beyond prayer and piety, paternal rage on a drunk. We waited, grasping the margin's lean embrace, pledged muscles to breasts, whittled bones from our hearts and lungs. We toughed it out in some rare collaboration, some fragile environ or ecosystem, hunched, inebriate, shimmering, shameless dust coming roseate, too delicate to amplify, passed through our eyes into our bodies, rough and fissured, kicked by Dad out from under our beds. For once, we knew just how to behave, if only we could get out of the way. And in intervals of vested, needled thickly as sheltered, halfway hidden, we vaulted, careering, certainly, but ascended, unbroken. This one is called Anamnesis, in the absence of light. And in my real life, all my windows have screens, but here, when the sounds of the day's night fly to the ceiling up and creep to the floor down, over nub-budded branches, legs glistening, anamnesis crawls into my mouth, and my father sliding the rose gold and onyx ring from his finger to mine, the meat of my thumb worrying the stone's chipped facet, his sorrows shift, his griefs transference. And in my real life, I talk to anyone who wags his tail to get a treat. Here, here, I speak only to cows, sheep, horses, mules, donkeys, barren hinnies, and jacks. High as stallions, I stand clear, hoary close winter's coats, sure, unshod hooves sunk in miry slush. And in this real life, I'm Valaine enthralled, the lands my body's captive toil. I'm against proportion, beautifully imperfect torque. Imbalance thrills me, thrilled. I'm off on a Viking, a medieval seeker on my couch in a cab, white underbelly of squirrels, my cloak guardians, tokens, piss unguent and sea balm. I'm traveler unmoored, the gemstones blind, the fetishes jagged precipice. invisible as black in the absence of light. Milfoil. In a box pew in the partisan's temple, earthed over underground, I'm the quiet one speaking endurance, compassion. In the unendurable, in the agra dolce bittersweetness, sleets, remorselessness stinging. And since you ask, it's getting cold here, going down below freezing tonight, possibly flurries, blanketed, surrounded as the warm barrel stove set solid, black oil smudged, summer lost, dust draped tables and chairs and chests of drawers, in wintry ice crust wood wax susurration slide, in dysglossia, the use of two languages to cast as one, pain and pleasure, snare and truss, snatch and shuck, birch bark brush my neck could have snapped just like. In the adolescence Bethel, in the basement, in the marriage of spur and widow's haunches, keeled stations of the cross, disciples carved on every lintel, slip raw, frostbound, voracious of unrefined, of ideologies and romancers, and shut in like me, wheelbarrows, snow, soundlessness under silk, pack, and harnesses spread, unwound in shape and light the things that comfort us, green-walled roads, gem-celled vivaries, our breasts safe asleep in emergency bivouac, my arms cast in pearly outskirts, the last of the butterfly weed post cutworm swarm and swallow, our first sex, oh. And in the tourist temple, milfoil chokes the chains, past lakes rough and cabins north, November's envoy absent omen, in that wriggling black sack we fished out from the trash. And finally, in the atavistic hour. In the atavistic hour, of course the flocks know where to fly and what to do with their spindly legs between silence and the world's white bones, post-shorn, wool scorch. In sun's first blush, in our still slumber, a pink blink, an orange swell, in luxury, in extremities transcendence, in the atavistic hour, the hour post-blizzard, in ignorance, in threat and tenderness, in our old habits, slow golden smile, in the purgatorial blaze, numb fingers and toes immersed. In the inheritor's hot memory shivery, a diapered child toddles out, a skating figure drifts and snumbles, stirruped, in arctic whorls and blanched stalks, plumed prairie. Our errors and perfections, our birthright, snowblind, etched icy in opalescent crust.
We are coming back to Ireland now and settling down here in Dublin, and it's time to get your rollerblades on, for we are welcoming a new voice to Eat the Storms, but not a new voice to the spoken word scene here in Ireland. For this artist has been writing for the past 10 years, although they only started performing in 2023, with their voices already a permanent fixture around the city of Dublin. His work has appeared in places like True Apathy in 2018 and Collected Thoughts in 2020. With a style described as quirky, please welcome, for the first time to Eat the Storms, Annam McCann.
True Rollerblader Scum by Annam McCann. I am the one true rollerblader. That's all I've ever done. Monday through Friday, Saturday, sun, through fight or flight, I am number one. But now, something's changed in the air. I feel it. You feel it. Infiltrating everywhere, systemic, epidemic, social contagion, skating through the nation, causing all the fuss. There are fake rollerbladers among us. In years past, they begot emo, mod, hipster, screamo, they're all the same. Don't know what they're saying, out there portraying, given us, no, given me a bad name. I am the one true rollerblader, and they're tripping over their toes with no internal balance, ruining my reputation with determination and malice. Sure, what they're going to do when the trend is over? Who would want them now? Their knees are cut, elbows bruised, ankles sprained, and head concussed. I am the one true rollerblader. My reputation is on the line. I will deal with the fallout that these will leave behind. I am the one true rollerblader. That's always been my fate. You say you skated since you were three? Well, I was born with roller skates. Male Gazing by Anna McCann. I love to look, linger, and peek. See, watching is new hobby for me. I just picked it up there last week. You wouldn't believe the sights, the yelling, the kissing, the fights. Stop the lights, the chatting, the laughing, the camming, the fuss, the walking, the running, the sprinting from the bus. There's no conversation too big or too small that I wouldn't be a fly in the wall. But still, what to do when the person behind the keyhole is looking back at you too? Because recognition from the object reminds you that you're you, full of your flaws and your defects, and that you can be stripped of subjugation too. So pack up your nicks, knacks, notches, your ego and your glory. We're going to go people watch from the safety of the observatory. Hoisted by My Petard by Anna McCann. Curie was killed by her radiations. Cochran's parachute gave out. Coles was drowned by his own automation. Sojak's stunt went south. Hiddleston was struck on his scooter. Fix was broken on a run. Brody was buried in his own gallows. Icarus flew too close to the sun. Aviation accidents to maritime miseries. The premature judgment days for premature flying taxis. Cause new ways to live brings new ways to die. Speedy on earth, speedier in the sky. To avoid being blown, blasted, singed or scarred, heed my advice. Steer clear of your own petard. Granda by Anna McCann. Our plumbing is kept together with stitches, our walls held up, bless. Our phone lines have been stapled together, but everything works perfect at our address. Our handyman didn't go by the book. No rules or regulations, essence of obsolescence, no hassles or frustrations. You know he was awful clever, always told me now, get the reap out of your head, just sew till bed. Things don't have to work forever, as long as they work for now. Get rid of your tears if the house collapses in 50 years. Another man's problem now. By and large, he shouldn't have been in charge of the electricity of the entire city, or all the phone lines in New York. Maybe we shouldn't have given that much power to a man who was from Cork. Things haven't been the same, though remnants still remain. Hammer dents, sellotape stains, asbestos in our attic, and lead in our drains. Still, no better man than Joe the Can wouldn't have followed a protocol or procedure or any advice given either. House still stands, all perfect and dandy, so you couldn't say that he wasn't handy.
Our next guest here on the podcast today is here to share poems from his debut poetry collection, which was just published by Arachne Press, called Birds Knit My Ribs Together. He is an artist who lives in Lancashire in the United Kingdom, and his work focuses on the natural world, in particular his patch, as in that square of countryside just outside his front door. As a musician under the name Squinancyworth, he works with synths, samples and natural sounds, and has recorded 5 albums, and a number of tracks have appeared on the BBC. As a photographer, he's had a solo exhibition and is also a visual artist using paint, mixed media, digital media and video. Today, he's sharing poems from his extraordinary debut collection, bringing us all those birds and white horses while watching flight from 10 years in a wheelchair. I'm very excited to welcome to Eat the Storms, Phil Barnett.
Hi, Damien. Thank you for inviting me on to Eat the Storms, and thanks also to Cherry Potts, editor at Arachne Press, for publishing my first collection of poems called Birds Knit My Ribs Together. I think the best way to introduce the collection is to launch straight in and read the introduction. Wren, coltit, bluetit, goldcrest. At the start of each month, I say the names of birds. Great tit, long tail tit, nuthatch, tree creeper. My mother writes them down. Blackbird, song thrush, missel thrush, black cap. For me to tick each day, I seed the bird. Robin, dunnock byed wagtail, house sparrow. I can't write them myself. My brain won't work. Greenfinch, chaffinch, goldfinch, bullfinch. I can't move. I watch birds. Wood pigeon, collared dove, feral pigeon, sparrowhawk. At the start of each month, I recite the scope of my world, the extent of my landmass, my ancient map. Lesser blackback gull, herring gull, black-headed gull, heron. At the start of each month, I say the names of birds. Jay, magpie, jackdaw, crow. So, during a decade-long period of wheelchair-bound illness, I would indeed say the names of the birds that came into the garden, and my mother would write them down so I could place a tick next to them on a piece of squared paper. And it occurred to me, not at the time, but later on, when I started writing poetry, that what I was doing was I was incanting birds. It was an incantation of birds' names. Writing poetry, particularly about that time, has been an act of understanding, of writing down things to see what I think, and gaining new insights on things. So my world shrank to a chair and a view out into a garden, and it was a garden full of birds. It wouldn't be too much of an exaggeration to say that I spent 10 years watching birds, and I often say that birds kept me going during that time, or even that birds saved my life. So I'd like to read two poems about the constellation of birds, constellation of nature, that I experienced at the time. And this one's called Just Sitting. A Prosecco world, still all winter, stirred in March, shaken in April. This morning, the cork comes out. Fizzing spring morning, jug after jug, poured through a bright hole in the sky. I want to share in it, to taste it, like spilt wine licked off the table, greedily, before it's gone. But today, I cannot walk. Not through those cloister woods to my bluebell church, music deep in black cap, that hoverfly and stitchwort springcraft, nor will I headlong into spears of it. Here, in this garden, I'll let nature wait on me, hand and foot and all the senses. The tincture of skylark, dripping song, neat, straight onto eardrums. Listening for that part with the long notes, where for a moment the whole world warps into one long note. I'm rooted to the spot, but I have roots. Today, I cannot walk. Everything is here. And this next one is called We Give What We Can. Cross my palm with robin, Just one pin, just one needle. Tiny claw prickle human hand. Blood orange bib bird. Across my heart line, along my love line. This pumpkin sky morning, sunrise has trusted me with a fragment of itself. We give what gifts we can. Me, a crumb of cheese. The robin, one drop of life's spittle. A wild bird comes to my hand, and for a moment, I am wild too. This next one was inspired by one of the saddest things that I've ever seen. A grounded house martin that had a wing missing. So a thing that belonged in the sky with no chance of ever getting back there. And it's called Wounds. Blue brittle sky, banged with a hammer, knocks out a piece, falls to the ground, mouth open, gulping. I found a god on the path, a small one, fluttering, broken-blooded, grounded pilot behind enemy lines, eyes like a drowned village. I picked it up, cupped, as if holding a fledgling angel. This lost jigsaw piece of sky, this little god of hurt, with scar tissue dreams turning wounds into stories. It lifted a wing, pleading. I pulled out a thorn, jabbed it into my heart. Not all of the poems are about birds, but there's nature in all of them in some form or other. Either focusing on the thing in nature or having nature as a metaphor or an illustration. This last one that I'd like to read is called Two White Horses. Without TV or news or clocks, time is measured in white horses in the field below. The morning brings a new alignment. They are an act. All the prepositions in front of, behind, next to, and some that only horses know, the stations of the horse. Two entangled particles play out a stately ballet on the clock face field. Clouds attracted by a strong force and repelled by a weak one. Next day they put on adverbs of time. Before, after, a long time ago, a very, very long time ago. And on the last day, they're performing verbs. Galloping, slowing, resting, lying down. Leaving the house for the last time, I turn to see a waft of white smoke that turns into a tail. Then two of them. Twirling, tick-tocking the seconds, or is it the years?
And just like that, we've heard from all of our four guests on today's show, which means it's time to go back to the beginning and explore our love of poetry and writing. And welcome back, Michael McKim, to today's Behind the Storms. So today I'm delighted to be joined by Michael McKim for Behind the Storms, who I had the joy of hearing read from his latest collection, Because We Could Not Dance at the Wedding, last year at the John Hewitt International Literary Festival in Armagh in Northern Ireland. Michael was born in Belfast, grew up near the Giant's Causeway, though now lives in London, working for the Geological Society Library. He was a graduate of Warwick Writing Programme,
won the Eric Gregory Award in 2007, and his first collection, Still This Need, was published in 2009 by Havana Tree Press. He was an International Writing Fellow at the University of Iowa in 2010, and Fossil Sunshine was his second collection in 2013, published by Whirlpool Press, who then published Because We Could Not Dance at the Wedding in 2023. In between all that, he's edited the anthologies Map, Poems After William Smith's Geological Map of 1815. Also, The Tree Line, Poems for Trees, Words and People, also by Whirlpool. His work has appeared in various anthologies around the world, including Best of Irish Poetry 2009, Best British Poetry 2012, Queering the Green, Post 2000 Queer Irish Poetry from Lifeboat Press, and most recently, Windfall, Irish Nature Poems to Inspire and Connect. Michael, thank you so much for joining us today for Behind the Storms, this little interview series.
Thank you so much, Damien. It's great to be here. And thank you for having me back on the podcast.
I'm very happy that you've come back. You joined us last year after I heard you read at the John Hewitt, and I was very excited about having you on, so I really appreciate that. I'm just going to start off by going back, because the podcast is all about beginnings, how and why we first got into poetry. So it's been, if I calculate right, 14 years since Still This Need, your first poetry collection, came out. But if we can go back just a little further, how did poetry first take hold? How did it sort of root itself so deeply into your character? How did it become your creative outlet?
Yeah, thanks. It's really interesting to reflect on, you know, beginnings, and I sort of feel writing for me goes all the way back to the beginning. I feel like I've always been writing, you know, as a child. Wrote a lot of sort of stories growing up, and the odd poem, but I sort of feel really, for me, poetry kind of took hold. As you mentioned, I came over to England in 2001 to go to the University of Warwick, and it was to study creative writing. And creative writing was kind of new then as a subject, particularly at undergraduate level. So it was really kind of exciting to come over and sort of be studying creative writing, and it was really fun and creative place to be. You know, I sort of come over kind of thinking, you know, short stories is what I was writing, and that's kind of what got me into Warwick. But when I was there, it was just, you know, the poetry kind of just took over. You know, we had really exciting teachers there, and this introduced me to such a wide variety of poets and types of mm-hmm. poems. It was a real grinding in like the craft of a poem, you know, the kind of all those things that for me make poetry kind of exciting, rhythm and metaphor and kind of tone and voice and everything that kind of goes into a poem, the craft of it, of making images as well. And I suppose poem being, you know, the most, just only the necessary words, you know, and trying to work out that kind of the puzzle of the poem.
It's quite cinematic, I think, to a degree, you know, these observations of what you see, whether it's at the window, whether it's on buses, whether it's on street walks, you know, it's very evident. And it's funny, because I was going to ask you if you felt that your writing style changed from moving from Northern Ireland to England, if that had an effect, because so much of your writing seems connected to your environment, to ecology, to your immediate surroundings. And yet, at the same time, you still seem to be able to see nature even through concrete.
Yeah, thank you. I had a rural childhood. My early childhood, we lived outside of Belfast in the countryside, and then I moved to the north coast. So nature and sort of the natural world has always been part of my existence. So I moved to England, and I've always lived in England in cities. First of all, lived in Coventry and then moved to London. But the natural world is still always around me, and is always part of, it's what interests me, but also it's just, I have an affinity with it. And, you know, I'm just looking out the window now at, you know, the trees out the window, and, you know, that's, you know, what catches my eye. But I sort of feel a, you know, even in an urban environment, a sort of deep-rooted sense of the natural surroundings, but also people within those surroundings and how they react to nature.
As I said, I heard you read from, because we could not dance at the wedding last year at the festival, and you were very gracious then to come onto the podcast. I think I sort of ran out and accosted you slightly and said, please come and read on the podcast. But I was reading it again the other day, and I think one of the most extraordinary things that I found about the collection is that while the majority of the poems are written or set during lockdown, you're locked down in good old concrete London, but there isn't a single sense of being trapped whatsoever. I think the entire collection, it flows almost like the River Thames. They're all about walks and going out and exploring. And you bring up on this sort of formation of a relationship. Someone described your work as urban pastoral. And there's an overwhelming sense of that here. Everything has this movement, even the layout and the form of the poems themselves. You have these sweeping long poems that run over pages through segments and sequences, some of which, as you said, you're looking out your apartment window now, or, you know, are just looking out that same window. But it's all about life and light and nature and flowers and trees. Even in the poem, What the Greenfinch Actually Sounds Like, you know, you're lifting these, as you say yourself, these dusty weights in your hands, but you're not, because suddenly you're in a forest, suddenly you're outside, you're stretching, rooting yourself, listening. Even the title poem, Because We Could Not Dance at the Wedding, which it could have been this solid, this confrontational piece, because it's about identity. It's about a time when two men were not really socially accepted to dance together. And yet in your hands, it becomes this magnificent waltz. It becomes this seductive dance, again, moving en route to the bedroom, en route to undressing, to exhilaration. How was it to put all of this together, this sort of orchestration that has its own chorus of birds that accompany it?
Thank you so much, Damien. And yeah, this is such a beautiful description of it. Thank you, of the whole book. Yeah, it's interesting how it came about. You know, because you highlight there what might be seen as two parallels, which is the love poems and the poems about being gay, and, you know, the nature poems. And originally, I had sort of seen them sort of separately. I actually had an idea for two pamphlets. I was actually going to just have a pamphlet of the love poems, and then I thought, oh, I've got these other poems about London, about kind of looking out the window, about being on the bus, and, you know, and they felt at that time that they were a sort of separate thing. And then I was really encouraged by Peter Carpenter at Warple Press to, you know, look at it as one thing, and in a way that the nature poems, they're also love poems in a way. They're about a love of place. They're about, you know, a love of community, and also, you know, they're a continuation of the domestic, which is part of the love poems anyway. And what I wanted with the book, when I decided, okay, it's going to be one book, is to have a kind of, even though the poems are different sort of forms and sort of styles, and but they've all got the same tone and voice. And I also wanted it to, as I think, as you know, people buy poetry books and they look at the contents and they go to the poem that they want to read. Mm-hmm. But I really wanted to do a book that is to be read in order, first poem to last poem. And if it is read in that order, I hope that you, as you say, there's a certain flow to the story. But also it means that when you reach, say, the Greenfinch, What the Greenfinch Actually Sounds Like poem, you don't need to be told that this is a person in a relationship, because the relationship is already laid out before you. And so when it describes a we of two people walking in the forest, you know who that we is. You don't need to.
It has that thing, you know, it has that almost novel-like feeling, you know, it has a chronology to it. Even in your, you know, your opening poems, the walks that go up, you know, there's this count up almost, you know, there's a count up to lockdown. And yet I think what's intriguing about this is that during lockdown, I think we all felt like life stopped, but life was all happening in there, you know, in these confined spaces. And I think that's what your collection also manages to do. It shows that things still went on. You know, we still moved, there were still visions, there were still, you know, things going on outside while all this was happening.
Yeah, and I also, I'm very interested in kind of
the multitude of things that can go on within a poem. So it can just be about me in a moment looking out a window, but then, you know, other things, you know, outside influences, something on the radio I might hear, and it's that kind of multiplicity of life, I suppose.
Yeah, and you filter in politics as well, like, you know, we mentioned earlier in terms of it being a collection, especially with the title poem. You know, it's a collection about being gay as well. It's about a collection about coming out. But the intriguing thing about this is that there are parts in it where you're political, but you don't beat down your own point. You are very calm, very gentle in terms of describing, I suppose, what us and me as a gay man and the LGBT community, what we've always noticed in terms of feeling on the outskirts of, but perhaps what the rest of society wouldn't actually pay attention to. So, you know, things like being able to comfortably or not comfortably dance at a wedding with our boyfriends or our partners or civil partners, being able to give blood, you know, as you demonstrate with your husband Zach in that poem Tattoo, where, you know, that frustration of being a healthy human being who's not allowed to give blood to save lives until he can, and there, you know, there's a jubilation, but there's also an anger of what has passed. And even as you demonstrate in terms of your civil ceremony, to a degree, there's almost this feeling of it being like a work contract that's being signed until you realize, you know, this is bigger. This is more than just that. And one of the final poems with your family at the end, you have this sense of this pastoral scene that gives us this vision of a family, but it's finally formed, it's integration, this feeling of things now being organic, perhaps as they should have always been. How important was it to get that across and to do it as so smoothly as you've done?
It's really interesting. I'm not sure how conscious I was of that. The poems were written over many years. The title poem, in fact, Because We Could Not Dance at the Wedding, that's the oldest poem in the book, and that was actually, I wrote that in 2008, so it's an older one. And then the Rummy Cab poem is actually the most recent one, and that was written just sort of in the 6 months before, you know, I put the book together. So yeah, I'm not entirely sure how conscious I was of the. I mean, I don't like overtly polemical political poetry. Yeah. It's just not been for me. But I also think all of the poems are true to my own experience.
Yeah. You're not coming across as, now this is now a poem about me being gay. You write, again, in terms of relating to nature, you write in an organic way. It's just, this is me expressing my point of view, but this is just me going through what I'm going through. Didn't necessarily think about it, but this is what's happening. I suppose even when in the poem Tattoo, there's a shock, and you have to sit down and question why Zach is getting so angry at having not being able to give blood. So there's an awareness of what has changed, but there's also this acceptance and this knowledge of, you know, those fields that we've crossed in order to get where we are. But it doesn't stop the entire collection from being this beautiful, complete whole that fits together so well.
Yeah. I'm thinking about Tattoo, the poem Tattoo about the blood giving, and I suppose that's one of the moments in the book where I kind of don't accept things for being as they should be. The anger, by the end of that poem, he and I are both still angry and about what is an injustice. But these poems, I sort of feel, you know, I write other different types of poems. But as I said earlier, for this book, I wanted it to have that unity of voice and tone. And so I suppose they're all written from a place of, you know, all of these poems, I was writing them for Zach. Yeah. So, you know, when I sit down to write something like that Tattoo poem, which turned out to be a long, long poem, I didn't know it was going to be that. you know, I think I was probably just writing it at the time as a way of sort of thinking through the issues and possibly, you know, maybe think, oh, something might come of this as a poem.
In terms of the layout and in terms of choosing it, was this already set up before? Was it a discussion with Whirlpool in terms of, you know, how you would, where you would place poems, you know, how many long poems, how many shorter poems, where to put them?
Yeah, I was very sort of determined at the beginning that I wanted them to be in this chronological order. And it largely is in that. Peter Carpenter at Whirlpool, who's is just a brilliant editor, and you know, we spent a long time really, you know, revising the poems and sort of editing them. But he, you know, he had the, what I think is turned out to be, you know, a lovely idea of putting, sort of splitting it sort of into sections with the love poems, love poem for Goshawk, love poem with Beach Coppard, and love poem with Sanderling, putting those at the beginning, the middle, and the end to kind of create a kind of structure to it. But the order, I think I was quite just determined of my ordering that it was going to be not, they're not chronological as they're written, but they're chronological as they tell the story of the relationship.
This is your third collection, and you wrote this, this came out last year. Your first collection, that was back in 2009. So how, you know, well, has there been a huge change in terms of your approach to writing and your, in terms of your approach to putting together a collection in that time?
I wonder, I can answer your question maybe by referring to Fossil Sunshine, which was, yes, the second book that came out, because, and was also with Whirlpool Press, because I find these two books could not be more different. Fossil Sunshine was a book about, it's a book about climate change and geology, and very rarely is the voice in any of those poems me. You know, those poems are written on a much grander scale, you know, a kind of geological scale. And I still do, as you know, I still have other poems that I write sort of like that. But this was very different in that I think it was so personal. It's almost like, yeah, I'd gone from the geological scale to this, you know,
almost confessional.
The living room scale or something. And in terms of the style of the poems, I mean, I've always sort of enjoyed using form in writing.
Yeah.
And trying to use sort of as much of a variety of form as possible, which it's always been part of my writing, you know, since I started. I think kind of, I suppose, you know, what hooked me first of all on poetry was kind of a sort of lyrical tradition in poetry. You know, perhaps unsurprisingly, growing up in Northern Ireland, you know, Seamus Heaney, Michael Longley, you know, two great big influences, and that kind of, you know, they absolutely experiment with form, but they maintain a rhythm meter and a kind of a consistent voice, I think, even in playing with form.
When was it for you then that you first thought, I'm a poet? Do you remember, was there a first moment? Was it the first collection? Was it the first poem that was published? Or was it, you know, was it instilled in you early? Were you encouraged to?
It's quite a funny one, because I almost get a bit embarrassed about being called a poet. I might sort of be more likely to say I'm a writer, or, you know, I write poetry. I don't know, you know, sometimes if people, you know, introduce me as a poet to other people, there's a kind of sort of, oh, you know, what's, as if there's some mystery to me or something, you know, or they're expecting kind of some sort of profound, you know.
Yeah, we're going to have to change the conversation now.
So it's interesting. I mean,
You started with prose. Are you still writing? Do you still write prose, or is the focus more on poetry now?
I'm very much focused on poetry, but I do write prose. It's something actually probably in the last few years I've been sort of getting back into, to writing short stories. Yeah, and very much that was a kind of a lockdown thing that happened, was that I kind of started writing short stories again.
Is it easier to call you a writer then? Is it easier to claim that title?
Yeah, I would be more inclined myself if, you know, to say I'm a writer, And a librarian.
and a librarian, and now looking after dinosaurs.
Yes.
What about, so what in terms of things coming next, do you have more readings plans and festivals coming up this year?
I've got a reading in Cork coming up on the 11th of March at Ovale.
Fantastic.
Paul Casey's Poetry Night. I'm really looking forward to that. I've read there twice before, but the last time was in 2013. So I'm really glad to be getting back to reading Cork again.
And it's a wonderful community, and they've managed to retain a certain amount of hybrid as well. And put them on Zoom, but now they've managed to retain this duality of it, which is fantastic. You're still connected abroad as well as being, you know, in the locality of Cork itself. Is there some prose coming in? Are you working on some prose pieces at the moment? Is that a possibility?
I think at the moment with prose, I'm just kind of doing, you know, just seeing where that goes and trying not to think about it too much, but I'm just trying to enjoy it. I've got project coming to an end, which is more back on the geology side of things, which is poetry. It's a collaboration with a photographer called Julie Cuthbert. We've been working on it for a number of years. So it's going to be a book of photographs and poems. I've written responses to her photographs, but also it's a poetry of the geology of the coast of the UK in photographs and poems. So that's coming out at some point this year.
Okay. All right. Well, we better all make room for that on our bookshelves. Michael, thank you so much. Really appreciate it. Thank you so much for joining us today on Eat the Storms. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you. Thanks very much, Damien. It's been wonderful. Thank you.
That's almost it for today, except there's a little bit of time for me to leave you one poem, and I've decided to read you a poem that was featured in the York Literary Review in 2022. I decided to read this poem today because Michael read about the Antrim coastline and Phil mentioned those horses, so this seemed like a perfectly good fit. This is called The Wave, and it's one of the poems that will be featured in my second poetry collection to be published by Tourist Press on the 8th of May this year. The Wave. Sometimes we fall down in order to slip out. Slope leans in to shore. Wild horse runs out to sea. We are more than just the wave that doesn't always know its weight. And less than the rock split open, bleeding infinite slivers, rust-coloured ore slipping from core out to coast. Even this land has scars the water cannot wash away. There are lairs scattered along this beach that only I can see, that only I have shed. Sometimes, in strange places, it is easier to see, safer to be seen, where we have yet to know the names of streets or share the spotlight of our sins. Sometimes, fucking is more honest than making love. Slope leans in to shore. Wild horse runs out to sea, and I watch, rust-coloured and bleeding, wondering how far out is the wave that will wipe
it all away. Poetic peeps and gentle persons, in-betweeners and nonconformers, genders all and genders equal. We've reached the end of another episode of Each the Storms, the poetry podcast. My name is Damien B. Donnelly. I've been your host and producer, and the stars of today's show have been Anna McCann, Maria Adamitz-Scrupe, Phil Barnett, and the star of our Behind the Storms interview today was Michael McKim. For details on all of my guests on today's show and all of my guests on every episode of every season, please head on over to www.eatthestorms.com, click on the podcast section called Listen to the Podcast, and there you will find a blog post for every episode. This was episode 8, season 8, and in that blog post you'll find bios, photos, social media handles, website links, where you can find, follow, support, cheer for my guests, be their fans and buy their books. And while you're there, speaking of buying, perhaps you might want to buy your own copy of The Storms, our printed journal of poetry, prose and visual arts. In the past, we've been supported by Fingal Arts and the Arts Council here in Ireland, and we've produced three magnificent issues featuring over 250 international contributors. And hopefully again later this year, we'll be opening submissions for issue 4 once the funding has been provided. Now, as I say at the end of every episode, please remember that we are an international community here trying to spread the word and create a platform to share our voices. And the only way we can do that is if you share your love of the podcast. So if you know someone you think would love the podcast, please let them know. We're available on 12 different platforms, including Spotify, Apple, Google, Breaker, Podbean, Player FM, Overcast, Pocket Cast, Castbox, Podcast Addicts and iTunes. Here at Eat the Storms, where there's always no pressure, only praise, we will praise you highly if you want to scream about us, shout about us and rave about us. At Eat the Storms, we realise that a stage is a very lonely place to be, but once it's shared, then it truly becomes a party. So that's it from me, your host, Damien B. Donnelly. Until next time, keep the sparkle, keep the shine, keep the creativity coming, keep the communities building, and keep coming back here for the One Poetry Podcast that ensures that you stay bloody poetic.
Oh, thank you.